Hello and welcome back to A New Sound with me, Morgan Brown. I can't even express how happy I am to be able to put out this episode. My guest on the show today is the incredible Hallie Bullett. A lot of people out there might know her from her work on The Chris Gethard Show. Some maybe even saw her on Broadway. However, I know her as the lead singer of one of my favorite bands, The Unlovables. I was very nervous to meet and talk to Hallie because her music has helped me out through so many times in my life, and I cannot express how cool it was to hear about her life, her music, her experience on Stomp, The Gethard Show, as well as her whole career through the music industry, which continues to this day. So without any further ado, I don't want to waste any more of your time. Please check out my interview with Hallie Bullett. So I'm hanging out here with one of the coolest people alive, Hallie Bullett. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
Thank you so much again for being here. I really do appreciate it. This is very cool for me.
Thanks for coming out to Queens to talk to me.
Yeah, we're hanging out in Queens at Lolly's.
There's the 7 train. I don't know. Can you hear that through
No, your we're good. I think we're okay. Lolly's, we're 90% positive about the pronunciation of that, but Hallie is a local here living in Queens. But thank you so much again. How are you? How has it been? We just talked about the move a little bit, going from Brooklyn to Queens. How's that been for you?
Yeah, I love Queens. Super happy here. It's like it's real New York.
I love that. Yeah, it's so cool. And then going out from Brooklyn, like we were talking briefly about how like music has changed and how the environment's been changing, or just like you said, the hipster bubble. Living like in the real New York City.
I was definitely in the hipster bubble because I was in the East Village, back when like Coney Island High and CBGB's and all these venues were still open. And so it was like, I didn't have to go more than 6 blocks to see like all the bands I liked, to like hang out in all the places I wanted to hang out in. And then I was in Williamsburg for a long time when Williamsburg was more like the center of things. And I've watched both of those neighborhoods.
Was that weird to see like Williamsburg be the new place where everyone's moving and like where all the bands are?
Yeah, it was weird because when I had some friends that lived in Williamsburg, like right at the beginning, like right when hipster kids were just starting to move there, and like it was still super cheap. The first set of friends that I had that lived out there, their apartment was so big. It was this big, gigantic loft
space.
That
was good living back then.
They had a half pipe in there. In their apartment, they were all skaters, and they could just skate in their living room. It was really awesome.
What was that like for the music? So many house shows all the time.
The music scene hadn't shifted out there yet. I mean, that was really when it was like the Wild Wild West. There were just like a few hipsters that had realized they could get a lot of space for like very little money, but there wasn't really a lot of music happening there yet. Like Death by Audio, all those venues, none of them had opened yet. That was sort of maybe like a few years later. I mean, I guess like in answer to your question, like I've watched this city and all the neighborhoods change so much. And like, I definitely went through a period where that was really hard for me. I think especially when you move to the city, you get very attached to the version of the city that's like yours when you first move here.
Yeah.
And I went through some years where it was just really hard for me, especially when all those venues in the East Village closed and they were all, you know, replaced with like fancy clothing stores. It was weird, and I went through a period where I just wouldn't shut up and like stop complaining about it. And it's been nice to like be here long enough that you realize like the city is always going to change. Like you can't get too attached to one version of it. And like in a way, like that's kind of the beauty of it, you know? And like whatever cool things close and are replaced by lame things, like the cool things are going to open up someplace else, and that's going to give another
neighborhood. You'll always be able to find a kale salad somewhere.
Absolutely. and like a good house show and like a good scummy like punk venue. You know, it gives other neighborhoods a chance to like have their moment, you know, to like get some cool restaurants.
Are you originally from New York?
I am, but you know, I have to qualify that because I was born in Manhattan.
Okay.
But my parents like very quickly like became miserable having like a toddler in the city. So we moved out to the suburbs like by the time I was three.
Where's the suburbs?
Like I grew up in Croton, which is like an hour north of the city.
Okay. Yeah. I have no idea where that is, but definitely sounds like the suburbs.
You know, living in the city now, we call it upstate, but like when I grew up there, we would have like laughed if people called it
like
upstate.
White Plains? Or is it like...
Yeah, just like, just like 20 minutes north of White Plains. Yeah.
I had some friends who like grew up like in White Plains area.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I thought the music there was fun too. How were you exposed? Music growing up in the suburbs? Were you always in New York going to shows? And
I was, but I mean, really just to truly date myself, like... You know, I would come in to go to, like, new wave shows. So, like, I wasn't going to, like, punk venues. I was, like, going to Radio City Music Hall to see Depeche Mode and, like, screaming
so
my head
fun,
off.
Though.
Yeah, it was incredibly fun.
Seeing those bands in their prime.
Yeah.
I worked at a record store for a long time. All my coworkers would give me, like, Depeche Mode records and all these, like, other post-punk and new wave bands. That must have been so cool.
It was
because there wasn't Terminal 5 or any of like the venues that are out now.
Yeah, we would. Yeah, we would go. You know, we would go see Erasure at like some big stadium show. So you know, I was, you know, a pretty typical teenager. I would say the music that I was listening to was like slightly cooler than most of my peers.
Okay.
It was like a little edgier. You know, everyone else was, I don't know what it was even popular back then. You know, it was like, it takes two to make a thing go right. Like, that's whatever.
That's punk. that's White Plains punk, baby.
Super punk.
So like, when did you start playing music? Like, when did you start like wanting to be like, this is, I want to be in a band?
Yeah, I mean.
Was there like a click for you? That was like, oh, I want to do this so badly? Or was it just like kind of a gradual thing?
No, it definitely happened in like a short period of time. Like I think for a lot of people my age, the progression of like listening to new wave and then getting into punk was like pretty normal. In fact, you may not know them, but there were these great comps that came out in like the like early 2000s that were called Before You Were Punk, and they were all like punk covers of new wave songs. But
that's
it was
so
sort
fun.
Of like acknowledging this fact that for a lot of people my age, it was like you started as a teenager listening to new wave, and then you got a little older and a little like angrier, and you wanted something that wasn't quite so like poppy and girly, and then like you started listening to punk. But
I think the comps I had were like the very basic ones, like This Is Hardcore, mm-hmm. stuff like those like random like. I mean, I had them on cassettes at some point, but, like, I think those, I think, do you think they got a lot of people into, like, the same music, or was it just, like, a you thing?
No, I think those comps were, like, super big at the time, and it was, like, everyone...
Like, when you were living in Brooklyn, like, you were like, yo, that one, like...
Yeah, like, awesome. It was, because it was all, like, Alkaline Trio and, like, Get Up Kids, and... I feel like it was like some punkier bands too, but yeah, all covering these songs that had meant like so much to my generation when we were younger, but it was in the style of like the music that we liked now. So it was super cool. I think, I started listening to punk and it was like the first time that I thought that I could do music because if it's just like, it's so beautifully simple, you know, and it's fun and it's more about just like having an attitude and just doing it as opposed to like being some musical virtuoso. So I think like getting into punk gave me permission to do music because I had sang my whole life, but I had never played an instrument. And so I'd started messing around playing bass in my apartment.
Bass first, huh?
Yeah.
I started with upright bass.
Oh, nice.
And then I started with guitar like briefly. I did right into upright bass, which, like, what's the saying? You could play bass like a guitar player, or you could actually play bass or something.
Yes.
Like, yeah. Unlovables was, like, iconic for the scene that, like, evolved in New York.
Mm.
But did you have any, like, pre-bands, just you and your friends, like, messing around with instruments?
I went right into that band. I played briefly in an all-girl band called the Hissy Fits. That was, like...
Great name.
It was a fun band, and I'm still so close with those... women too. It was like a really pivotal experience for me because I just played bass in the band, but it was like how I learned to be in a band. The singer Holly was like really good about, you know, just knowing how to book shows. And I went to Europe with that band. It was my first band ever. Wow. We toured Europe.
So when you say I went right into the levels, you were already like touring.
It was sort of simultaneous. It was playing in the Hissy Fits and the Unlovables at the same time. Okay. And so it was almost like in the Hissy Fits, it was almost like I got this great internship in like how to have a band. And then
you were just taking notes the whole time.
I was just watching Holly hustle. Like she was really good at that part of it, which like I think I'm probably better at the part where you just like write songs and play them. But like it was good to watch someone who was like truly great at booking and hustling and like
just
the
like
actual business
the
part of it,
yeah,
where
sure.
you actually make sure that your music is heard by people. So I was just sort of like watching her and learning, and everything that I learned, I like applied to the Unlovables.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, in the way that when you see somebody doing something right, sure. you're like, oh yeah, that's how I should do it.
Okay.
But the Unlovables was kind of a funny thing because it just started as like songs that I was playing in my room for myself, or you know, playing for my friends to make them laugh. I'd write a song, like a friend, a song for their birthday, or I'd write a song about my cat. I mean, just really dumb, simple stuff that I didn't really know if I'd ever do anything with it.
And who was the one who'd tell you like, you should do this?
Yeah, it was really, it was like a combination of, I don't know if you knew this band Dirt Bike Annie. They were definitely in the like New York pop punk scene.
I think I know
at
them
the
through
same
listening
time
to Spotify.
As us. They were great at the time. They just put on an incredible live show. Their songs were like so catchy and so fun. I would say they really started
like
the
you.
New York pop punk scene.
Wow.
And they
awesome.
Helped me record some songs that were songs that I'd written for friends that I was literally just giving them as presents. And then it was really those guys that were like, these songs are good songs. Like, why are you just giving them as presents for friends? Like, why don't you actually do something with them? So, yeah, it was really through them and through Christian Tattletale was the first guitarist of the Unlovables.
Okay.
And he really pushed me as well. And he had already been playing in the Tattletales and like knew sort of that same thing of just he knew how to have a band. I didn't know that. I didn't understand how to get a show or how to get a label.
So you had these people who were just so talented at that aspect just pushing you, which is, I think that's an incredible way to come up as a musician.
Yeah, it's really lucky because I think a lot of people, just that piece of it seems very intimidating. They're like, how, I don't know, I have, you know, my friends and I play songs in our garage, but like how in the world would we convince a venue to like let us play them in public? I think for a lot of people that can be kind of a stumbling block.
Do you think it's different now that everyone, like before, I mean, I feel like it was how many tickets do you sell? But nowadays I feel with Spotify and iTunes and all these streaming platforms, you could just record a whole record in your room, just put it out and hope someone listens to it.
Yeah, no, you're totally
completely
right.
Different.
I hadn't really thought about it. It is really different, right? Because you could just start that way. You could start with the recording, and if it's something that's like good enough and catches people's
ears,
then
people are going to ask you to play.
Exactly.
Which is, I think, I grew up in that way. I grew up in, like, I think my first band, great name, Chainsaw Bunnies.
Yes.
Killing it. Killing it. We grew up in that way. We were just three people who were just wanting to play music, and then we found the venue and then found like the early like battle of the bands, just like really pushed. I don't even think we really recorded anything. We were just trying to do the hustle thing, and I think I took those same skills I learned into like the other bands that I grew up in, which I think it's a skill that a lot of people, not saying don't have anymore, but I think just the whole industry has changed so much.
Yeah.
That it's different to like, because you might have like three albums streaming but never play a show.
Yeah, but I think there's also, right, there's some beauty to that because
definitely.
Because of what you and I are saying, like it was kind of, you know, it was hard to like approach these venues with your with your demo, like, CDR and, like, beg them to
let
you
play
a
show.
And that's still a big part of it. But I think there's more, like, there's maybe more DIY venues now where you're not having to beg some, like, jaded middle-aged guy that, like, doesn't listen to the kind of music that you like. Maybe the people booking the shows are more like your peers, and maybe they, like, appreciate more the style of music that you're doing. And also, how amazing for a band to, like, just have the capability of recording themselves and putting music out there, and then they don't have to, like, pound the pavement with a CDR. You know, they
I can't even tell you how many times I was turned away.
Yeah.
Like, ever. I think I walked down just, like, a street in Boston, just, like, every venue is like, can we please play here? And they were like, no. There's no way we're going to let you play our 2,000-person venue. You've never played a show.
No, like, you're with your pride. Like, back then, like, you really had to eat shit a lot.
Oh, my gosh.
It was, like, not that fun.
Which is the same kind of thing in New York, obviously. When you were coming up, was it same kind of deal?
Yeah, I mean, it was, yeah, the booker at CB's would be some, like, guy in his 50s that, like, only wanted, like,
CBGB
music. I don't
know, music.
Like, only wanted, like, the Dictators to play, like, these old, like, punk bands. And you'd be like, right, but we're doing something that's, like,
the same
kind of new
started
and kind
with
of fun. Maybe it sounds, like, silly or poppy to you, but, like, this is what kids now, like, really want to hear. But it was hard trying to convince people.
You started the Unlovables.
Yeah.
And then you took the point to, when did the Hissy Fit Unlovables break? When did you focus solely on that group?
Yeah, there was probably like 8 months or like a year of overlap. And then I got too busy. I was like, also, you know, I used to be a theater performer too. And
I have so many questions on that later, but keep going.
But I was doing that show Stomp at the time. And so I was trying to perform in Stomp every night and play shows with the
Unlovables. But you were also in Stomp?
Yeah.
That's how, well, okay. Moving on. We'll get there.
Yeah, I get paid to play music on, like, trash and household objects for 3 years.
Gosh.
It was very surreal.
Well, while we're on the topic, because I was trying to do as much research as possible, I can't pronounce the name of the show. Fuerza
Bruta.
Okay.
Yeah.
I tried Googling photos of that show. Mm-hmm. What was that like? Because it looks insane.
Well, yeah, that whole era, like, when I did Stomp, when I did Fuerza Bruta, it was like, I had gotten a reputation around the city for being able to do, like, really physical theater. Fuerza Bruta was, like, a show that had a lot of aerials, so we were using rock climbing harnesses and ropes, and we flew over the audience's head. There was a giant pool with a clear bottom that was suspended over the audience's head, and we performed in that, and the audience would be below us looking up at the performance taking place above them. It was
the
incredible.
Most punk musical theater experience that you could have.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't even call it a musical theater. I'd call it, like, physical theater, or, like, maybe even, like, performance art. But it
performance
was like
art, yeah.
But it was really, yeah, it was very punk in that,
that
it was
is,
like, super rebellious. It was, like, super physically,
just
it was super
out there,
difficult.
But people probably, like, loved it.
Yeah, people kind of freaked out for it. It was really fun.
That's so cool. So you're doing those types of performance art pieces and still doing the Unlovables?
Yeah, and trying to do bands at the same time. And that was why I finally stopped doing the Hissy Fits, just because everything that I wanted to do was all at night. It was like Stomp was at night, Unlovables shows were at night, Hissy Fits shows were at night. And it was like,
you only
I
have
just, I didn't
so many
have time.
Hours in the night. Yeah.
Yeah, I just didn't have time. It was sad, though, because it's fun to just play in a band.
It is.
And, like, I really miss that because,
it
honestly,
really
I haven't
is.
Really done that since. Like, every other band I've been in since is a band where, like, I was writing songs and I was booking shows, and there was, like, something so glorious about just being, like, that shithead bass player that just, like, shows up and, like, does, you know, I just, like, all I had to do was, like, all I had to do was play the songs. I didn't book the show. I didn't help book anything. I was so lazy. Then, you know, I got my comeuppance because then I would, you know, I'd be in bands where I'd not be getting help from, like, my fellow musicians, and I'd be like, this sucks. This is exactly what I did when I was in the Hissy Fits. I just wasn't a helpful band member, but it sure was a lot of fun. I miss that relationship to music where, like, all you have to do is just show up and play it. Like, that's absolutely the best.
That is literally so fun. I can't even imagine, like, what it was like. Just the performance art with the band thing must have just been, like, not taxing on you, but when was your last show? Like, when did you kind of stop doing the theater thing and then do the music thing?
So Squares of Bruto was the last show I did, and I had to retire from that kind of work because I had an accident in the show. Ooh. So I got, like, really badly hurt.
Understood.
Oh, yeah. People were getting hurt in that show all the time. It was just what happened. So, yeah, I did it for 3 years, and then I had an accident. My body was like, girl, no. You are done with this kind of work. And it took me, like, a couple of years to recover from that accident. I actually wasn't really playing much music even at the time. Or rather, I should say, I wasn't playing in the Unlovables because my back was so hurt that I actually couldn't lift my bass.
Wow.
But luckily, that was right around the same time that I started playing music on the Chris Gethard show, and they didn't need me to play an instrument. They really just needed me to sing. I got really lucky in that all of a sudden this musical project kind of fell into my lap where it was something I could actually physically do.
So was the Chris Gethard band, was that always the LLC? And when did you like meet up with those people?
It was, it had been this, there was this incredible pop punk band that had been like in New York City for like many, many years called the Kung Fu Monkeys, which
great name.
They are so worth looking up. It's like super spazzy. Kind of twee, like some of the stuff is kind of surfy, some of it's just like twee and some of it's garagey. It's like all super smart. The guy James, who is like the main songwriter, he ended up moving to Canada because he got like this fancy professorship at a university up in Canada. And when you listen to their songs, they're spazzy punk songs, but like if you listen to the lyrics, there's always like really clever rhymes. Like, you know, when it's like fun, simple music, but you really listen and you're like, oh, but this is an incredibly smart person making these dumb songs.
I find that all the time, and specifically the types of music. Like, you hear like, I mean, just songwriting stuff, but like consonants and things that just shouldn't like work, but you're like, how did they rhyme this word with that? Looking up lyrics is a guilty pleasure of mine. Truly. Mm-hmm. So I'll definitely have to check out that band.
Yeah, they're really good. And so Chris Gethard was like a huge fan of that band, and he was friends with the singer. And so when he started the Chris Gethard show and needed a house band, he just asked James. He was like, hey, would the Kung Fu Monkeys want to do this? So they were the band that played on the show when it was still a stage show at the Upright Citizens Brigade.
Used to be, sure.
And then when they moved the show to being on public access was right around the time that James moved. So basically it was like his backing band was still willing to be on the show, but James was the song. He was the singer. He was the songwriter. They were like a backing band with no leader. And so I just got super lucky. Those guys were longtime friends, and they asked if I would come in and take over that role. And it was...
Did you know Chris and them prior, or...?
I didn't really know Chris. I had been a fan of the show when it was at the Upright Citizens Brigade, so I used to get out of Fuerza Bruta. I would be, like, sopping wet, right, because I'm, like, performing in this pool. My body would be so beat up. I'd be so exhausted. But I would, like, throw on my clothes, sopping wet, and I would run across town from Union Square to Chelsea to the Upright Citizens Brigade so I could go see the Chris Gethard show once a month. Because at that point, when it was a stage show, it was only once a month. So it was really fun that they asked me because I was already a fan of the show.
Sure.
And when they asked me, I had just had my accident, and I wasn't in the show. I wasn't in Fuerza Bruta anymore, and I didn't know what in the world I was going to do with myself, like, artistically. I couldn't do the Unlovables because I couldn't lift my stupid bass. I mean, I was really in bad
shape. How much later was... Did you already put out the two records with the Unlovables first before all the... Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it was...
I'm trying to get the timeline.
It was, yeah, no, it was two... We had put out two full lengths and an EP, and we'd done a bunch of touring. And then, yeah, I had a little bit had to phase out the Unlovables when I was working on Fuerza Bruta just because of my schedule.
Sure.
But then, yeah, you know, just as soon as I stopped doing Fuerza Bruta and I could have turned back to the Unlovables, then I just kind of physically kind of couldn't. So I got so lucky that the Gethard show kind of, like I said,
swooped in.
It just, like, fell out of the clear blue sky at a time when I was, like, really needing something creative that I could do, and I wasn't sure what that was going to be. So, yeah.
Now, when you took over the spot, is that when you got, like, really close with like Chris and like the crew and the band, and then that's like how a lot of other music stuff like came out? Or
yeah, I mean, because when we switched to the public access platform, if you want to call it that, you know, then suddenly we were doing the show once a week. So it was we were doing it for free, so it wasn't like, you know, and we were all, you know, grown adults trying to, you know, do other things in the city. So it wasn't like we were spending all week working on the show. And when you look back at those old public access episodes, it is clear that we didn't put that much preparation into them.
I was watching a couple today, actually, just to prepare. So, and it looked wild.
We would basically, you know, the show was, we taped live at 11 p.m. on Wednesdays. And basically, the band and I would get together at like 5 p.m. on Wednesday.
Practice
we would write the songs that we were going to play that night, practice them quickly. I would cram a bunch of lyrics into my head, and then we would just pray that they were going to not sound terrible on public access. And I would say half the time they sounded terrible.
Oh, my gosh. That is DIY TV.
Absolutely.
That is awesome.
And it's very similar for the writers. I think they would get together briefly on like a Saturday afternoon to just come up with like just a loose outline of what the show was going to be. And then they wouldn't think about it again until Wednesday. Except maybe Chris. He would be running around getting like dumb props. He'd be out like buying like dildos and whatever we needed for the show that week. But
what was it like going from the public access times to like these now major networks? Has it been like taxing, or has it just been like, or has the attitude kind of stayed?
It was really like the most surreal combination of both. Because it was all that we really brought most of our crew and our whole creative team when we
switched.
When we finally got a cable deal, we pretty much brought everybody with us. So in some ways, it was just the same old bunch of jerks like making dumb television, and there was something really
fun. But now you guys
fun.
Got paid for it?
Yeah, but now we got paid, and also now we had a network to answer to. That's, and a lot okay. of times the network, you know, the network would, you know, they'd say, like, well, we want to produce your show because we've seen what you do on public access and we like it so much. But then you'd find that, like, actually what they really wanted to do was, like, they wanted to change a lot of things about it. So it was a really funny, weird combination of, like, oh, it's just our same old show with our same old friends and the same just kind of bull crap that we normally do. But then, yeah, it did change it somewhat to have a network involved. It was very much like that typical Hollywood story of just sort of
like the plot of Wayne's World.
Like, exactly. It's so funny. I hadn't thought of that, but like literally, so exactly. The plot of Wayne's World. Yes.
Oh, jeez. So, and you went through two networks at this point.
Mm-hmm.
What was it even worse the second time, or was it better? Or
the money is involved, yeah, because, you know, we kept you know, sort of trying to move up the ladder of the TV world, so that the last network we worked with was definitely the biggest one, and that was where we were, you know, finally really making a decent salary for all the work that we were putting in. But yeah, you know, it just, the demands were greater, and they, you know, when they're putting that much money into a product, you know, they're nervous and they have their own jobs to protect. You know, we're talking about TV executives, you know. It's like the more money is involved, the more people just, they get nervous. And then the nervousness makes them picky and exacting and kind of demanding.
Sure.
And so, yeah, it just definitely, the pressure, just every time we made a big step forward in the industry,
sure,
it became a little bit more pressure, a little more stressful, and a little less creative control. That being said, all our networks were nice to us. You understand.
Of course.
There are people with jobs to do.
That makes perfect sense. I think I was happy to have attended one episode. It was very fun.
Which one?
Slam Dunks and Slam Poetry.
Oh, that was a ridiculous episode.
I was there. It was wild.
Nice.
It was really fun. But I was happy to go because I've been watching since the public access times.
Yeah.
And I realized I wanted to go. Me and my friend were like, we like this show. Let's just do it. And then we were just like, oh wait, we actually sit on the floor. Okay, cool.
And like, what was your experience like when you came? And because I think we were on sort of our first cable network, I think, still at that point. Yeah. So they were a smaller network.
It was fun.
But did you find the spirit of it? Like,
was it
the same as what you would have expected from having
Absolutely.
Watched the the public access
not
shows.
A question. It was yeah. It was from like I said, from a fan who like really did want to go and was like really excited about it. I thought it was great. The people that were in line with us, wild.
Yeah.
It was absolutely insane. There's one person that me and my friend, we talk about all the time. He's in every episode. He's like wearing a coonskin hat. He's there all the time in random spots. And we're like, we need to meet him and to just talk about like what he does on the weekend because I'm interested.
Our fans are the best.
How do you, does that warm your heart about how much reach you guys have?
It was like, it felt a lot like the Unlovables, actually. Sure. Like when you just, you make something and you put it out there and you hope people are going to like it. You have no control over that, really. And then like you just get lucky and it turns out that like not only people like not only do they like and support what you're doing, but the people that like and support what you're doing just happen to be like kind, like creative, funny, nice people. Like you don't always get that. I mean, I don't take that for granted at all, you know? It was one of the weirder things about eventually we were on a network called True TV, mm-hmm. Which just because, I mean, the network is great and the executives were all, like, fun, creative people, but their audience tends to be a little bit more like Midwestern bros, and it was the first time that I was, like, making art and putting it out there, and a lot of the people that were watching it were just maybe not like the nicest people.
Really?
And it made me realize how lucky I had been in my career and in all my artistic endeavors that until then I had really just had the like really incredible privilege of like making art for nice people.
Well, I want you to know, and maybe this is just me telling you how much reach, like I was in middle school and someone showed me and I was like going through the public access and found the Unlovables and I fell instantly in love with that first record.
That
was, so that's a good bridge because I have some few questions on just that record specifically.
Nice.
Again, growing up, I loved that record so much, but some of the songs almost became like blueprints to like how I was, like the song, one of my favorites, Feeling All Emo, mm-hmm. Since I Broke Up With You. Great song.
Thanks.
But I would pause it and just be like, wait, what band did she mention? Okay, I have to listen to that. Okay, cool. Like, I learned, like, the Get Up Kids, and I knew Jimmy Eat World, but didn't know Clarity.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know what I mean? But like,
Clarity's a great album,
oh my
right?
Gosh.
Yeah. That's the one for me.
I'm also kind of mad because you kind of ruined my college experience with that record, telling me about that. Like, I love that record, and I was like, and like, learning about all, like I knew a little bit about like some of the bands that you talked about and like those records and stuff, but that had like a huge reach.
Yeah.
To someone like me. Is that what you like were listening to at the time, or was it just, were you just making references? Because at some points that song feels like a satire, but sometimes it's not. It's crazy.
You know, we all have like guilty pleasures
right.
in music. Like when, like I think my attitude towards emo was different from a lot of people because I was like just a little bit older when the emo thing happened. So it was like, I was super into punk. Punks were like definitely skeptical about emo.
I bet there was a huge backlash.
And I had like a healthy skepticism about it, but you can't deny like those, especially that first wave of bands that were doing the emo thing, like they just wrote good songs. So it would be the kind of thing where I'd be listening and I'd be like, this is so sort of like hard on your sleeve. I'm a punk. Like I'm not supposed to like this stuff, but it's just, I like good songs. I'm not, if you play me a good song in any genre, I'm gonna like
it. I mean, I feel like the same way with like other like country, even like,
yes.
I like, if it's a good song, then it's a good song.
Yeah.
That's kind of all it takes. Now, I was going to ask, when you first, like, met Chris and everything, I know that he comes from the Jersey music scene.
Mm-hmm.
Was there, like, a rivalry at all between, like, you guys, like, talking about music and, like, where you both came up from? Or is it just
Well, so the drummer for The Unlovables is Mikey Erg from The Ergs, mm-hmm. and he was such a Jersey guy that I think The Unlovables had always, like, even though we were a New York band, we'd always had such a, like, we'd had a really strong connection to the Jersey scene. The kids in the Jersey scene had always been super welcoming, and we had played our...
Did you have bands, like, because I feel like those, like, that scene, was that like Nightbirds and, like, all of those Jersey bands, or was that later?
Nightbirds was later, because Nightbirds is, like...
Because I know that's a huge band for Jersey people.
Yeah.
One of my really
Rightfully
good...
Rightfully so,
one of my really good friends,
band.
One of my friends in, like, my family was telling me, he was... he grew up with them. So when they showed up on the Gethard show, they're like, we made it. Like, that was like one of the, like, you have that attitude going from like being a Jersey band to like have that. So I was wondering if that's like the same thing with being a New York band.
I mean, in a lot of ways, I would say that Jersey had a better scene than New York because the city is so expensive and it's hard for musicians to live here to get by. I think, you know, I don't know if you're finding this, but like, I think a lot of people move here to make music or to be an actor or to be a dancer. And then they find that a lot of what they're doing is just trying to make their rent.
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
So in a lot of ways we were as a city band, and there we are, we're playing a CBGB's, we're in, you know, we're playing.
Is that weird to start playing at venues like that? Cause yeah, I mean, from being denied earlier to then like, oh, I'm in a band that they want us to play at CBGBs. Was that a weird existential thing?
I think by the time we finally played like it just specifically like CBGBs, we'd been at it for a couple of years and we'd really been working hard. So I think by the time we finally made it out of that stage, we felt like we'd earned it. Hadn't come that easily, you know.
But like, I can't even imagine like how happy you guys must have been.
We were super
happy.
Because
when did it close?
It closed in maybe like 2000. I'm going to say 2001, right. Maybe.
So you guys just made it.
Yeah, exactly.
That must be the coolest.
In under the wire.
Oh, my gosh.
But, you know, we would look at those kids from the Jersey scene that were just able to put on shows in their house. Like, none of us could have put on a show in our apartment. Our apartments were the size of a shoebox, you know?
Sure.
So I think we actually had some real envy of just, like, there's
being able to be on
the
beach in Asbury Park.
Yeah, and, like, the space and the freedom that you get from, like, being not in a major metropolitan area, you know, maybe your cost of living is a little bit lower. Maybe you actually have a basement. I never had a basement in any of my like crappy, like walk up apartments, you know?
No, totally.
So it was ironic, you know, we'd experience that on tour too. We'd go to these smaller cities and, you know, we'd sort of the first time I rolled into Milwaukee, the first time I rolled into Cincinnati, I came in with this like city slicker attitude of like, okay, little crappy city, show me what you got. And then, you know,
and then Midwest emo happened.
And the shows would be freaking
insane.
Packed with people, like happy people, like people that loved music and knew all our songs. And like, you could just.
Was that the point where you guys felt the reach? Where you were like, wow. We're really making an impact on like a lot of these Midwest teams.
Yeah, those first couple tours we went on were really crazy because we'd show up into a city that we had never played before, just assuming that no one was going to show up. And then like, you know, it's again, we're talking about like punk scale of fans. Like we'd have 30 people show up and know all the words. But like, exactly.
Course.
You know,
of course.
You know, especially for a city that you'd never played, you'd be like, how do you know us?
How do you know that I play in a band? That's wild.
And then like the other bands that we'd be playing with, you'd see where like they had like a house, a whole house to themselves, you know, play all day long. All they wanted to without having to pay for a practice space. They could record an album if they wanted because they had the space to do that. And we'd always come home being like, maybe New York City isn't as cool as we thought it was. Like maybe all these smaller places are like way cooler, you know?
You just see people
having more freedom, more creative freedom, and more freedom with their time and their money.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What was your, I gotta know, was there a crazy tour story? Horror story, anything bad that happened? Did it happen in the U.S. or when you were touring Europe? Like, what was a breaking point that you were just like, what's going on?
Oh, Europe was really funny.
Because if you're talking about going from New York to the Midwest, I can't even imagine the feeling of being like a young punk band doing your first tour in Europe. That's
crazy. I
mean, crazy.
I have a bunch of stories. I'm trying to think which would be like the most gratifying for you to hear. Like, you know, probably the Unlovables played a really funny show in San Diego. We were on tour with the Ergs. It was the first time either band had been to the West Coast.
And Mike here was doing double duty.
Yeah. And it was, that tour was a little sad because the West Coast was really far from where we were. And the internet wasn't as big a thing yet. And so you couldn't rely on the internet to like spread your music as much. You had to actually go to places and like play a show
and have people see you, then build your audience. Yeah, sure.
And so that first West Coast tour
brutal
was really brutal. You know, it's so funny now when you think, you know, like we were on tour with the Ergs. Like I watched the Ergs played in like random biker bars in Northern California to like five people, like so pitiful. But we loved it. We had such a good time. But we played a show in San Diego that some friends had booked for us. They had had a little bit of trouble finding the show. What they had ended up doing was finding a show that already existed and then just basically begging the bands and the venue to just add these two touring bands, which is a big ask. So we show up to this bar in San Diego. I had watched the Ergs like swim in the Pacific Ocean for the first time that afternoon. We were all still like full of like salt water and just like loving California. Like the tour sucked, but like we loved just being in California.
It just matters who you're with. If you're having fun, that's all that matters.
Totally. And we like show up to this venue and it was like a very like artsy show. The band that played right before us literally played from inside a tent and they were playing like just like random like kind of acoustic instruments. So it'd just be this like cacophony of noise coming out from this tent. And then all of a sudden you'd see like a recorder would like pop out the tent window and just be like, and the crowd was like loving it. I mean, it truly was like one of the strangest, like most fantastic
and then you
things
guys
I've
were
ever
like,
seen.
Oh,
and then we came on to just play
so
our
loud.
Dumb like our dumb punk songs, and like it just wasn't the it wasn't the vibe of the show or the crowd or anything. You know, I'm so proud of all the stuff that I did with the Unlovables. I'm still proud of those songs.
You should be.
But every now and then you just. You know, you'd have these experiences where you'd just be like, oh, these are just dumb punk songs. You know, you'd be like, when you're playing them for a crowd that doesn't like appreciate that, it like you suddenly see pop punk for its flaws. You're like, oh, this music is kind of dumb.
Were you singing Today's the Day, but like kind of like second guessing, I don't know if I want to go through this.
Yeah, you're like these art school kids don't want to hear a song called Today is the Day I Finally Kissed You. Like it's like all of a sudden I could see how sort of cloyingly cute it was, you know. I was like, oh, I wish I was doing something artsy inside of a tent. It'd be way cooler right now.
I feel like that's a very validating feeling for anyone else who's doing that. You gotta just stand by what you like and what you're, you know what I mean?
Yes.
People will like whatever they want.
Yeah.
Just go for it. When
Yeah, and you're not gonna be able to please everyone.
Of course.
Impossible.
So when now Chris Gethard's going, how many actual seasons has it been on major television?
So we're not doing the show anymore, but we did. It,
how many seasons was it?
It was four.
Four seasons, right?
Technically, it's three. Because the last network that we were on, when we did our third season, and then when they renewed us for more episodes, they just decided to call it, like, season three, part two, as opposed to just calling it season four. But we really, we basically did four seasons.
But that's awesome. Yeah. So when you were having all of these, because I know you guys had bands that I grew up loving, and then people that, like, you had the reunion shows a couple times that were like big bands. Like, didn't the Ergs play?
The Ergs played.
Huge reunion.
We had some. We just could never believe our luck, you know.
I grew up listening to like one of the bands that I grew up like loving, who I actually got to meet and talk to for a while, which was huge for me. Was like the Front Bottoms. Like you had them twice. The Public. So like you had like all. Did you like remain friends with all those people? Was it like? What was the dynamic when they were playing?
A lot of them were still friends. I mean, anyone that played on the show, we
had
have
some
like a real connection
yeah,
to.
Sure.
Like still, it was just one of those things. I mean, I think everyone's had that. It was like that one, you know, that high school soccer team that you played on, where like just for whatever reason, everyone just got along like so well, and it was such a good experience for everyone. It's like even if you don't keep in touch, if you run into those people,
I think we feel
that way about like any band that played on the Gethard show. Like in terms of like our actual friends, like we're really good friends with all the guys that play for Jeff Rosenstock. We're like really good friends with Laura Stevenson. There's like definitely like a bunch of bands that have come through that like actually we would just hang out with. But even the ones that I'm not like texting them on a regular basis.
But if you saw them on the street, you'd be like, yo, what's
there's,
up?
There's something real there.
Well, I think that's the essence of like the Chris Gethard show, and that's what it was.
Yeah.
Is where anyone can be anywhere and like be friends with like so many different people and just like have that common connection. I would recommend people to watch that show because you guys had the bands that my friends liked. Like, it wasn't like big late night shows that were doing top 40 songs. You guys had all these bands where you could learn music that you didn't know originally.
I think yeah, so I mean, cool. I got exposed to a ton of great bands through the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, Hallie, thank you so much for sitting down with me. I really appreciate you doing
Queen. Oh, what a fun conversation. Thanks really so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much. And is there anything you need to plug or anything?
No.
Just ready to be a mom?
I am very pregnant right now. So, yes, that's my next, the next album I have coming out is
Are you excited for your kid to be as punk as you? Are you going to?
Well, that's the thing with kids, right? Is that a weird thing? Right? My kid will probably end up, like, working in finance because, right, your kid is going to reject the thing that you like. Although, you know, my mom was a musician and a theater performer, and I, like, very much followed in her footsteps. So we'll see. Maybe we'll get lucky. Maybe our kid will be a punk or a comedian.
Well, I really hope the best, always.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much again.
Thank you so much for listening. When we recorded earlier this year, Hallie was pregnant, and I just wanted to say from me, all your fans and listeners, and congrats to you, Chris, the whole family on a healthy, beautiful baby. Thank you so much for listening, and talk to you next time.